Hello, everyone. My name is Hannah, and you are listening to Mystic and Murder, a paranormal, unexplained, and true crime podcast. On today's episode, we will be talking about the abduction of Barney and Betty Hill. Barney Hill Jr. was an African-American man born on July 20, 1922 in Newport News, Virginia. He was the youngest of four siblings, and when he was still in school, his family relocated to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He graduated high school, went on to attend Temple University, and later enlisted in the Army. After his service in the Army had concluded, he began working for the United States Postal Service in Philadelphia. He had married his high school sweetheart, Ruby Horn, and together they had two children named Barney III and Daryl. However, he and Ruby later got divorced. Betty Hill was born Eunice Elizabeth Barrett on June 28, 1919 in Newton, New Hampshire, with a specialty in children's welfare. Betty was also previously married. In 1941, she married a man named Robert Stewart, who she had met at work. Robert was a divorcee with three children, who Betty legally adopted. They divorced after 14 years of marriage due to her husband's infidelity. As for Barney and Betty, they met in the summer of 1956 while the Hill family was vacationing at a friend's home in Hampton Beach, New Hampshire. At the time, Betty was working as a cashier and hostess at a beachfront restaurant to help pay for her college tuition. She met and became friends with Barney and Ruby. Later on, when Barney and Ruby had divorced, he contacted Betty. They had intended on just being friends, but as they spent more time together, their friendship grew to love, and they married on May 12, 1960. For the first 10 months of their marriage, their jobs forced them to live apart until Barney was finally able to transfer from Philadelphia to Boston, Massachusetts. This new commute was still 60 miles from his new home with Betty in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, but if it meant being able to live with his bride, he would do it. Barney and Betty were both well-respected and known as pillars of their community. They were an interracial couple, which was unusual for the time, and they were both civil rights advocates and members of the NAACP, or the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. In fact, Barney was the chairman for the Legal Redress Committee in Portsmouth branch of the NAACP. He was also an executive board member of Rockingham County Community Action Committee, and on the board of directors of the Rockingham County Poverty Program. He was one of five people recognized by New Hampshire's governor for his outstanding service to his community. Barney was even invited to the inauguration of President Lyndon B. Johnson in 1965. Together, they were one of the first widely publicized claimants of an alien abduction. On the night of September 19th, Betty, age 41, Barney, age 39, and their dog Delcy were coming home from a long-awaited honeymoon weekend to Niagara Falls in Montreal, Canada. Barney was driving their 1957 Chevy Bel Air on Interstate 3 along the White Mountains of New Hampshire. Sometime around 11 p.m., Betty spotted a strange light in the sky. She pointed it out to Barney, who thought it was a star or a plane or maybe they were lucky enough to witness a satellite that had gone off course. They continued their drive, but they noticed that the light grew even bigger and brighter as they moved towards it, and it seemed to be moving erratically. Now, UFOs were not something commonly talked about in the 1960s, but since the Roswell incident in 1947, people speculated that maybe aliens did exist. In fact, Betty's sister Janet had even claimed to see a UFO before. Delcy, their dog, seemed to be growing restless, so Betty suggested that they make a pit stop along the side of the road and maybe even get a closer look with the binoculars that they had brought for their trip to Niagara Falls. Barney pulled over near a picnic area where they got out of the car. Betty was the first to look in the binoculars while they stood at the side of the road. Delcy began to whine and cower beside them, so Betty handed the binoculars to Barney and got back in the car with Delcy. Barney focused on the object with the binoculars and listened for a familiar sound like propellers running or a jet engine. Nothing. Just silence. He got back in the car, and they continued to drive for a while. They saw the object disappear behind the silhouette of a mountain and reappear on the other side of the car. Barney tried to ignore the existence of the light. Meanwhile, Betty could not stop looking at it. The object now appeared to be only a few hundred feet in the air, and it actually appeared to be rotating. Betty grabbed the binoculars and peered out the car window. She gasped as she realized what she was seeing. This thing was no airplane or satellite. It was large and oddly shaped, flat even, and it had multicolored lights and a double row of windows. "Barney," said Betty, "you've gotta stop. You've never seen anything like this in your life." Barney glanced into the sky from the windshield and saw just how much closer this object appeared now. It was definitely coming closer to them and was probably no more than 200 feet above them. Barney stopped the car in the middle of the road and grabbed the binoculars. With the car still running, he hopped out and looked into the sky. He was not prepared for what he was about to see. The craft was flat, like a pancake, with windows that curved around the perimeter. On each side of the craft were fin-like wings with shiny red lights on the tips. Mesmerized, Barney moved further into the field, closer to whatever this thing was. Betty yelled at Barney to get back in the car, but he couldn't hear her. He put the binoculars to his eyes again. Behind the windows of the craft stood several figures. Barney described these figures as being, quote, "somehow not human," end quote. Suddenly, all but one figure backed away from the windows. Barney then claimed that the figure communicated with him non-verbally, and it said, "stay where you are." The craft began to lower and the wings expanded. A long structure began to descend from the bottom of the craft as it got closer to the ground. It was then that Barney realized what the beings intended to do. He felt that they were there to capture him and Betty. He tried to pull the binoculars from his eyes, but it felt like they were glued. It took all his energy to rip them away from his eyes and run. He ran from the field, jumped back into the car, and started driving as fast as he could along this isolated highway, trying to escape the craft, which was now hovering over the top of their vehicle. Barney instructed Betty to roll down the window and see if she could spot the flying saucer. Betty stuck her head out the window, expecting to see the lights of the craft, but all she saw was darkness. She couldn't even see the sky. Everything was just black above her. As she rolled the window up, she and Barney began to feel the car vibrate, and they heard a series of buzzing and beeping sounds coming from the back of the car. They began to feel drowsy as a tingling sensation swept over them. The next thing they know, 2 hours have passed, and they're now in Ashland, 35 miles south of Indian Head National Forest, which was their last known location. They have no recollection of how they had gotten there or what had happened over the last 2 hours. All that they can recall was encountering a roadblock somewhere along the way, and they both have a vague recollection of a fiery orb, but their thoughts are so muddled. Once their minds began to clear and they no longer felt drowsy, they decided that they would tell no one about their experience because, as Barney said, quote, "no one would believe it anyway. I find it hard to believe myself," end quote. They arrived home at 5 that morning. It took them much longer to get home than it should have. The drive that was supposed to take them about 4.5 hours actually took 7. Betty and Barney weren't actually aware of this until they got home because both of their wristwatches had actually stopped working. They both felt very strange and dirty even. When Barney was unloading the car, Betty asked him to leave their luggage outside. She wasn't sure why she felt this way, but she didn't want it in the house. Barney agreed. He unloaded the luggage on their back porch and went to finish clearing out the car. This is when he noticed that the leather strap on his binoculars was broken in half. When Barney finished unloading the car, he felt compelled to examine his body. He stated that, quote, "I could hardly wait until I was able to get everything from the car to the back porch so that I could go into the bathroom where I took a mirror and began looking over my body. And I don't know. I didn't know why at the time, but I felt unclean, with a grime different than what usually accumulates on a trip. Somewhat clammy." End quote. Afterwards, they sat down together to talk about the experience. They even separately sketched what they saw, and their drawings were identical. Again, they agreed not to discuss this with anyone. They went to bed, relieved to be home. When they woke up, Barney noticed that the top of his dress shoes he was wearing, which were his nicest pair, were all scuffed up and dirty. Betty looked at the dress she was wearing and noticed that it had a tear from the waist all the way down to the hem. The fabric around the zipper was torn, and the hem of her dress was hanging down on one side. She folded it and put it in her closet with the intention of sewing it back up. Several days later, she took it out and noticed that it was covered in some sort of pink, powdery substance. Betty had reported that at first she threw the dress in the trash, but quickly changed her mind. This pink powder is one of the only pieces of evidence that the Hills had from that night. It was analyzed in 5 different laboratories. Proteins and oils were found on the dress that did not belong to Betty and could not be identified. The areas most saturated with the pink powders are the areas that Betty later claimed that these creatures actually touched. So, why then was the suit that Barney wore that night spotless? The couple said that after the incident, Barney had taken his suit to the dry cleaners because his clothing hadn't been damaged. Now, back to the morning after the incident. Over breakfast, the Hills continued to talk about the night before. Barney held strong in wanting to keep this incident between them, but Betty began to think that she should share the experience with her sister Janet. Remember, Janet had claimed to see a UFO in 1957, but the details of that case were never released to the public. After hearing the whole story, Janet told Betty that if the UFO was hovering over them, her car and her clothes could have been exposed to radiation. She told Betty that she should call the nearby United States Air Force Base to report what they had seen. First, they decided to investigate the car. When looking at the vehicle, Betty and Barney found multiple, quote, "shiny concentric circles," end quote, on the trunk that had not been there previously. They even took a compass to these circles, noting that the needle would move faster and faster the closer they got to the circles, but would react normally anywhere else. Betty was fascinated by this, but Barney just assumed that it was a cheap compass. Still, Betty decided that she would take her sister's advice and report the incident. Barney was initially against this reporting. He just wanted to forget about the experience, but Betty thought it was important. On September 21st, she made the call to Peace Air Force Base and spoke to an Air Force investigator. She reported the sighting and gave minimum details because she was afraid of what people would think. She told the officer about the fins with red lights on either side of the craft, and the officer seemed to become more interested. He asked for more detail, which Barney actually agreed to give since he had gotten a better look at the craft. The following day, they received a call from Major Paul W. Henderson to collect an official statement. The Air Force informed her that an unidentified craft was actually tracked on their radar at 2:14 a.m. The Hills believe that this was right around the time the UFO left. On September 26, the official report made by Henderson was filed and forwarded to Project Blue Book, which was a code name for a United States Air Force study that was researching UFOs. Its main goal was to analyze the UFO-related data and determine if it was a national security threat. This sounds promising, but unfortunately for the Hills, Henderson's report concluded that they had most likely misidentified the planet Jupiter. The report was later changed and labeled as having insufficient data. Was there really nothing to be found, or was this just a way to sweep it under the rug? What about that blip on the radar at 2:14 a.m.? A few days after the incident, Betty decided to investigate what had happened to them on her own. She believed it was something extraterrestrial, and she began researching UFOs. She even checked out a book called The Flying Saucers Are Real, written by Donald E. Kehoe. Kehoe was a retired Marine Corps major who was now a director of a civilian UFO research group called the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, or NICAP for short. In the book, Kehoe made claims that extraterrestrials have been visiting Earth for centuries, but their visits were being investigated and covered up by the United States Air Force. Betty decided that she would write a letter to Donald Kehoe and tell him everything. After receiving the letter, it was passed on to Walter N. Webb, an astronomer and chairman of the Boston Investigative Unit for NICAP. After reading Betty's letter, he agreed that they should meet in person. On October 21st, 1961, Walter drove from Boston to Portsmouth and met the Hills at their home. He would be the first of many to interview them. Walter stated that, quote, "Despite the sensational nature of the story, I decided to approach the claim critically and with the proper scientific skepticism," end quote. He interviewed them for 6 hours. Barney and Betty told Walter everything that they could recall from the evening of September 19th. Barney even stated that he couldn't remember everything, and he thought that there were some parts of the night that his subconscious mind just didn't want him to remember. Betty addressed this in the initial letter to Kehoe, saying, quote, "His mind has completely blacked out at this point. Every attempt to recall leaves him very frightened," end quote. 5 days after the interview, Walter typed a 6-page report to NICAP. Walter later stated that, quote, "I was so amazed, impressed by both the Hills and their account, that we skipped lunch and went right through the afternoon and early evening. During that time, I cross-examined them together, separately, together, re-questioned them again and again. I tried to make them slip up somewhere, and I couldn't. I simply couldn't. Theirs was an ironclad story. They seemed to me to be a sincere, honest couple, driving home from vacation late at night on a lonely road when something completely unknown and indefinable descended upon them. Something entirely foreign or alien to their existence." Later on, a former Air Force intelligence officer, Major James McDonald, heard about the Hills and suggested that they try medical hypnosis. Betty and Barney agreed that this could be beneficial in helping them understand their experience. In fact, once hypnosis was suggested, Betty thought of the dreams that she had had around 10 days after the incident. They were vivid nightmares that continued for 5 nights in a row. These dreams felt so intense and real that Betty decided that she would write them down. Barney was sympathetic to Betty about her dreams, but he tried to reassure her that they weren't real. Betty knew that Barney would rather forget about the whole thing, so she really didn't tell him much about what happened in her dreams. An excerpt from The Interrupted Journey by John G. Fuller states, quote, "Her dreams were unusual in subject matter and detail. They revealed that she encountered a strange roadblock on a lonely New Hampshire road as a group of men approached the car. The men were dressed alike. As soon as they reached the car, she slipped into unconsciousness. She awoke to find herself and Barney being taken aboard a wholly strange craft, where she was given a complete physical examination by intelligent humanoid beings. Barney was taken off down a corridor, curving to the contour of the ship for apparently the same reason. They were assured in the dream that no harm would come to them and they would be released without any conscious memory of the strange happening." End quote. Were these dreams, or were they actually memories being uncovered subconsciously? Because of this, Betty was eager to undergo hypnosis. Barney, on the other hand, was a bit more reluctant, but he too was curious because of this mental block that he felt he had, as well as the time he just couldn't account for that night. He was also hoping that this would allow him to ensure Betty that her dreams were just that, and there was no need to worry. Before they underwent hypnosis, the Hills decided to return to the scene as suggested by Walter Webb. They went several times, hoping to recover some memories of the incident, but nothing came of them. One of Betty's friends recommended a psychiatrist by the name of Dr. Patrick Quirk in Georgetown, Massachusetts. Georgetown was only about 10 miles from Portsmouth. Betty wrote a letter to him on March 12, 1962. On March 25th, they met. After interviewing them, Dr. Quirk agreed that hypnosis could be beneficial to them. However, they all decided to postpone treatment at that time. Dr. Quirk ruled out the possibility of them somehow having the same hallucination, which eased some of the Hills' concerns. Then, one day they were invited to a discussion group at the Unitarian Church they attended. A speaker at this meeting was Air Force Captain Ben Sweat. He was well known in the area for his study of hypnosis. The Hills relayed their experience to Captain Sweat, who suggested that it would be a good idea if conducted by a psychiatrist. At the time, Barney was already seeing a psychiatrist by the name of Dr. Duncan Stevens due to other events in his life unrelated to the UFO incident. He brought the incident and the idea of hypnosis up to Dr. Stevens, who thought that they should look into the incident as it may help Barney with his anxiety. The doctor also stated that it was highly unlikely for he and Betty to have a simultaneous hallucination, let alone simultaneous amnesia. For this to occur is highly rare, though not impossible. There is a condition called folie à deux, literally meaning madness by two. It is a rare psychological condition that occurs between two people who share the same delusions and beliefs. Most of the conditions to confirm this diagnosis were not present between Barney and Betty. Dr. Stevens thought it best to refer the Hills to a well-known psychiatrist and neurologist in Boston named Dr. Benjamin Simon. They set up a consultation for December 14, 1963, where he learned of their general backgrounds and came up with a treatment plan. Dr. Simon agreed to perform time regression therapy via hypnosis in order to determine what had actually happened on the night of September 19th. By using time regression therapy, a patient's memory becomes, quote, vivid and exact. There is also the tendency to relive, recreate, and reenact the time segment being recalled, so that the subject again goes through the emotions involved in the original experience, end quote. In a hypnotized state, Dr. Simon guided Betty and Barney back to that night and asked them to recall every detail of the trip, from Canada to Portsmouth. These sessions took place separately so that they could not hear each other's version of events. These sessions were also recorded on tape. In the beginning, they were under complete hypnosis and they were told that they wouldn't be able to remember anything from the sessions, but as they went along, Dr. Simon began to allow them to recall these events in consciousness once it was safe enough to do so without causing trauma. These sessions began on January 4, 1964, and continued through June 27th of that year. It is important to note that Dr. Simon was neutral to the possibility of UFOs. He had no personal interest in the subject and was unfamiliar with NICAP. During hypnosis, Barney was very emotional at times and kept asking to wake up. This is the summary of what Barney was able to recall of the missing time frame. He heard a series of beeps. He kept driving, but he realized that he was not on Route 3 anymore. He was lost. At some point, he had turned off, but didn't know why. The road he was on was in a heavily wooded area. Up ahead, he sees figures in the road, and they seem to be flagging him down. The area that they were standing in was brightly lit, almost as if it were daylight. They were all dressed alike, and he remembered seeing a pair of eyes with no body, just floating like that of a Cheshire cat. He was told non-verbally to close his eyes, and he felt as though the eyes he saw had imprinted into his own. He stated, quote, "I got out of the car and I put my left leg on the ground and two men helped me out. And I did not walk. I felt like I was being supported and I did not go very far, I thought, before I felt like I was going up into a ramp of some kind. My eyes were tightly closed and I was too afraid to open them." End quote. He recalled feeling very weak and that his feet were dragging as the men carried him. He was too afraid to open his eyes, so he kept them closed for most of the time. When he did open his eyes for a second, he saw an exam table in the middle of a white room. He was made to lay on it, and he remembered it feeling unusually small for a human because his feet were dangling off the table. They took his shoes off and examined his body. He could feel them touching him and inspecting his spine. He felt a scratching sensation on his arm and felt as if a circular cup had been placed on his groin. He remembers thinking that he should examine himself when this was over to see what they had done to him. They were examining his mouth when he heard others excitedly come in. They allowed him to get off the table and put his shoes back on. He was then told by the leader that he would forget everything. In his first session, he can be quoted saying, "And I'm getting off the table, and I've got a big grin on my face. I feel greatly relieved. And I'm walking, and I'm being guided. And my eyes are closed, and I open my eyes, and that is the car. And the lights are off, and the motor is not running. And Delcy is under the seat. I reached under and touched her, and she's in a tight ball under the seat, and I sit back, and I see Betty is coming down the road, and she gets into the car, and I'm grinning at her, and she's grinning at me, and we both seem so elated, and we're really happy, and I'm thinking, this isn't too bad. How funny. I had no reason to fear. And we look, and I see a bright moon, and I laugh and say, well, there it goes. And I'm happy. It was a bright, huge ball. Orange. It was a beautiful, bright ball. And it was going, and it was gone." End quote. He then remembers Betty laughing and saying, "Well, do you believe in flying saucers now?" And he replied, "Oh, Betty, don't be ridiculous." And then they heard a series of beeps. Betty gave a lot more detail during her hypnosis sessions. It is thought that maybe Barney couldn't recall as much because his eyes were closed for most of it, or perhaps it really was all just stemming from Betty's dreams, as some theorized. During the sessions, Betty also displayed a lot of emotion and was crying and even squirming in pain at one point. Here is a summary of Betty's recollection. It started with beeping. She saw that they turned off Route 3, and she didn't know why. They saw a group of men in the road that were dressed alike and flagging them down. All of a sudden, the car motor died and they came to a stop. Barney tried to start the car and it wouldn't start. The men then separated into two groups, one walking towards the driver's side and one the passenger. Betty wanted to run, but she was overcome with a sense of drowsiness. The men opened up the car doors and grabbed them. One man was on each side of them, holding them up by their arms. Betty was in front of Barney, and she was calling to him, saying, "Barney, wake up!" when one of the men said, "Oh, is his name Barney?" Betty recalled that she did not answer him, but began calling out to Barney again. The man asked, "Is Barney his name?" Again, Betty refused to answer. Then the man said, quote, "Don't be afraid. You don't have any reason to be afraid. We're not going to harm you, but we just want to do some tests. When the tests are over with, we'll take you and Barney back and put you in your car. You'll be on your way back home in no time." End quote. According to Betty, he was the only one of the group who spoke English, but he had a foreign accent. The men took them to a clearing, walked her up a ramp, and into the craft. Once inside, they walked down a curved corridor and into a room. The room was void of color, mainly white with a bluish light. She waited for them to bring Barney in, but saw him being taken past the room that she was in. She said, "What are you doing with Barney? Bring him in here where I am." And the man said, "No. We only have enough equipment in one room to do one person at a time. If we took you both in the same room, it would take too long. So Barney will be all right. They're going to take him in the next room, and then as soon as we get through testing the both of you, then you will go back to your car. You don't have to be afraid." They had her sit on a stool while they placed a machine on her arm, which Betty said was almost like a microscope, but not. She assumed that they were using this to take a picture of her skin. They took out a device that looked similar to a letter opener and scraped her skin with it. They then took the skin and placed it on what looked like a glass slide. They examined her eyes, mouth, throat, and teeth. They swabbed her ears and took strands of her hair. They examined her body, including her hands and feet. They also scraped under her fingernails and took fingernail clippings. Then the examiner told her that he wanted to check her nervous system and instructed her to take off her dress. The examiner unzipped it for her and had her lie naked on the metal exam table. He then brought over a cluster of needles. Betty described each needle as having a wire on it that connected to some sort of screen with lines on it. She said that they didn't stick her with the needles, but touched her with them from head to toe, and it didn't hurt. Sometimes the needles would make her leg or foot twitch, which seemed to please the examiner. After that, the examiner brought over a needle that was about 4 to 6 inches long and had a tube attached to it. Betty asked what it was for, and he said it was for a simple test. Then he stuck the needle in her navel, and Betty began to cry out in pain, begging them to take it out. The leader came over and ran his hand over her eyes, telling her that it would be all right and she would no longer feel it, and Betty said the pain just went away. She asked the leader why they put that needle in her, and he said it was a pregnancy test. After this, they allowed her to put her dress and shoes back on. Again, they helped her with a zipper of her dress. She recalled being relieved that she could go back to the car now, but they told her that Barney's exam wasn't done yet, so it would be a few minutes longer. The examiner left the room, leaving Betty alone with the leader. She said that she felt grateful to the leader because he had stopped her pain, and she wasn't afraid of him. She began talking to him and stated that this had been quite an experience and that no one would ever believe her, that she needed proof. The leader laughed and asked what kind of proof she wanted. She grabbed a book from a nearby shelf and asked if she could take it. The leader said yes. She asked the leader where he was from, and he asked if she knew anything about the universe. She said, no, only that she was taught in school about the solar system and the 9 planets. He then pulled out a map to show her. Betty described this map as, quote, an oblong map. It wasn't square. It was a lot wider than it was long, and there were all these dots on it, and they were scattered all over it. Some were little, just pinpoints, and others were as big as a nickel. And on some of the dots, there were curved lines going from one to another. And there was one big circle, and it had a lot of lines coming out from it. A lot of lines going to another circle, quite close, but not as big. And these were heavy lines. And I asked him what they meant. And he said that the heavy lines were trade routes, and that the other lines, the solid lines, were places they went occasionally. And he said the broken lines were expeditions. End quote. He asked if Betty knew where Earth was on the map, and when she said no, he laughed and said, "If you don't know where you are, then there isn't any point of my telling where I am from." And with that, he put the map away. Then, Betty heard a lot of noise and excitement from the hallway. The examiner and a group of men came rushing into the room. They seemed very excited. The examiner asked Betty to open her mouth, and they began pulling at her teeth. The examiner said he couldn't figure it out, but Barney's teeth came out, and Betty's did not. Betty laughed and told the examiner that Barney had dentures, and explained what that meant because they didn't understand. The examiner and the leader had many other questions for Betty that she tried to answer. She explained that she didn't have all the answers, but there were people on Earth who would be happy to talk to them and answer their questions, but if they ever did come back, she wouldn't know where to meet them. To this, the leader laughed and said, "Don't worry, if we ever decide to come back, we will be able to find you all right. We always find those that we want to." Betty asked the leader what he meant by that, but his laughter was the only response. Then, they brought in Barney, whose eyes were still shut. They were told that they could go back to the car now. As they were about to walk down the ramp, the leader came up to Betty and took the book out of her hands, saying that the others objected her to having it, and they wanted her to forget what happened. Betty became angry because this was her only proof. She exclaimed that she wouldn't forget, and she would remember it somehow. She even hoped that one day they would meet again. Once they got down the ramp, the leader said, "I'm going to leave you here. Why don't you stand by the side of the car and watch us leave?" Betty returned to the car to see that Barney was already there. His eyes were now open, and they stood together by the side of the car to watch them go. As the craft leaves, it begins glowing brighter and brighter, and it looks like a big, glowing orange ball. They get back in the car, and they start to drive. Betty said, "Well, Barney, now try to tell me that you don't believe in flying saucers." And Barney said, "Oh, don't be ridiculous." Then, they heard a series of beeping. As you can see, there are many similarities between their sessions. The feeling of being lost, the men in the road who guided them to the craft, the white room with the metal exam table, the skin scrapings, the excitement over Barney's dentures, being told that they would forget everything, the fiery glowing orb, and the words that they said to each other right before they heard a second series of beeping. There really aren't many differences between them. Rather, just a lack of detail coming from Barney. During his sessions, he even stated while he was hypnotized that he did not believe in UFOs, did not want to believe in UFOs, did not want to believe that this really happened, and just wanted to forget it all. As for Betty, little did she know, the events and details of her dreams were almost identical to those in her hypnosis sessions. After the hypnotic sessions were deemed complete, the Hills agreed to sitting in therapy sessions together while they listened to the playback of the tapes. They would listen for 10 to 15 minutes at a time, and then stop for discussion with Dr. Simon. They were also able to have him stop the tapes if they felt too overwhelmed, or if they felt they wanted to talk about it more. Listening to the tapes actually caused the Hills to recall certain details that had not been uncovered during hypnosis. Barney stated that while he listened to the tapes, he felt as though, quote, Suddenly the lost pieces began coming together. End quote. He remembered that he was the one to break his binocular strap. When he was standing in the field, looking at the craft, the strap of the binoculars was around his neck. After realizing that the figures wanted to capture him, he ripped the binoculars away from his eyes so hard that the strap broke in half. After listening to the tapes, he stated, quote, "I felt so overwhelmed and relieved. Now parts of my life that I had been missing were added to it again. Parts of my life were being put back together." End quote. Betty recalled that when the creatures were restraining her by the arms, she, quote, "kicked like hell," end quote, while fighting to escape their grasp. Could this explain the damage done to the skirt of the dress? They both could also recall more details about the men, who really did not look human at all. They described the creatures as being around 5 foot tall, with grayish, almost metallic-looking skin. Betty recalled the leader and the examiner looking slightly different from the others, a little taller with broader chests. They all had, quote, "rather odd-shaped heads, with a large cranium, diminishing in size as it got toward the chin," end quote. They had cat-like eyes that were slanted and continued around the side of their head. They had no hair, slits in place of nostrils, and a very thin line for a mouth. Out of their mouth came a sound. It wasn't actually English as they had initially thought, but a mumble. Their mouths would part only slightly as they did this. Betty stated that while it was not English that the creatures spoke, she could understand what they were saying to her as if it was. She wasn't sure if it was verbal or nonverbal, but she knew that she was responding to them verbally. Barney stated that he did not hear an actual voice, but in his mind, he knew what they were saying. And remember the eyes that Barney had felt imprinted into his own? The ones that he described as floating like a Cheshire cat's? He recalled that the eyes seemed to follow him, and he thought that they belonged to the leader. He knew that the leader was not in the same room as him, but felt that the leader could still communicate with him and had the capability to watch him, even though he was not physically there. Barney had also recalled that he had already forgotten what had happened by the time he got back to the car and opened his eyes. He had no recollection of what had just happened. He found himself wondering why the car was off, as he usually didn't shut it off for a rest stop. Then, when he saw Betty walk out of the woods, he assumed that he was waiting for her. Betty then said to him, "Come out, let's watch it leave." And at this point, he thought, "Watch what leave?" As he and Betty watched the craft leave, he recalls thinking that it was just the moon. Then he remembers his mind feeling foggy for a while after that. Betty recalled going into some sort of hypnotic trance when the men walked up to the car door because her first impulse was to get out and run into the woods to hide, but suddenly she felt as though she was asleep. They think that the beeping they heard was the creature's way of mesmerizing them and putting them in this trance-like state. Betty believes that she forced herself out of this state with sheer willpower. She stated, quote, "I could feel the struggle I was making to get myself to wake up again after the men seemed to put me in a trance. I could remember shaking my head and feeling as though I were trying to climb out of a well. I was really struggling. I could remember saying to myself, 'Oh, I've got to wake up, I've got to wake up,' and each time I would say this, I would force myself a little more awake. When they took me out of the car, I wasn't very cooperative. When we got to the ramp, I think I probably braced my feet against it. Then I remember either this voice or the thought, whatever it was, saying to me that I wasn't going to be harmed." Now, let's talk about Betty's dreams. She stated that the 5 dreams that she had were each segments that matched up with the information that the hypnosis sessions uncovered. These dreams did not occur in chronological order, but in writing a report of the dreams, she did her best to pair them up accordingly as she now could recall the sequence of events. Like I said before, her dreams were almost identical. there were only three discrepancies that occurred between them. The appearance of the men, the entry into the craft, and her willingness to forget. Under hypnosis, Betty recalled these men as being very alien in appearance. They had bluish-gray skin, pear-shaped faces, wider at the top and narrower at the chin. They were bald and had very large cat-like eyes, slits for nostrils, and a very thin line for a mouth. In her dream, they looked like humans. They still had bluish-gray skin, but they had noses and hair. Their hair was dark, and their noses were larger than the average humans. They weren't frightening to her in the dream. When it came to entering the craft, she dreamt that she had to step up one or two stairs before getting onto a ramp. Her recall under hypnosis was that it was only a ramp, no stairs. As for her willingness to forget, Betty recalled through hypnosis that she was very adamant that she would not forget them or the experience she had. She would remember them, even if others would never believe her. At the end of her dream, however, she had the thought, quote, "Good luck, goodbye, and I am going to forget about you. If you want me to forget, I will, and I will not talk." End quote. Everything else that she dreamt was how she recalled it under hypnosis. The fiery orb, the fighting to wake up, the examiner, the test, the leader, the star map, everything. How is one to know if the dreams were actually real memories, or if Betty had believed them so much that she was able to repeat the events under hypnosis? Barney had recalled much of the same details and events, but one argument is that although Betty did not tell him much about the dreams, Barney had heard her telling others about her dreams, and perhaps that had influenced his subconscious in some way. The only evidence that they had for any of this being real was the pink powder on Betty's dress and Betty's recollection of the star map. In one of her hypnotic sessions, she stated that the details of the star map weren't so easy to remember from her dreams, but now that she's seeing it under hypnosis, she could probably draw it. When she was released from her trance, Dr. Simon suggested that she draw the star map at home if she felt compelled to do so, and she did. Marjorie Fish, a schoolteacher in Ohio, heard of Betty's star map. Using several different scientific databases, she began building 3D star models to see if Betty's star map could be legitimized. It took 6 years for Marjorie to come up with a model that matched. The reason being? The star data that completed the model wasn't released until 1969. The stars were a formation called Zeta Reticuli. Interestingly enough, these stars are barely noticeable to the naked eye, and even more noteworthy, Zeta Reticuli cannot even be seen from the northern hemisphere. So how would Betty possibly have been able to draw a star formation that was not even visible from New Hampshire and included stars that wouldn't even be discovered until 8 years after the incident? In an article written for Journal News in Hamilton, Ohio, Marjorie stated, quote, "Since we did not have the data to make such a map in 1961 when Betty saw it, or in 1964 when she drew it, it could not be a hoax. Since the stars with lines to them are such a select group, it is almost impossible that the resemblance between Betty's map and reality could be coincidental. Betty's map could have only been drawn after contact with extraterrestrials." End quote. Marjorie Fish passed away in 2013. Her obituary states that, quote, "Later, after new data was compiled, she determined that the binary stars within the pattern were too close together to support life, so as a true skeptic, she issued a statement that she now felt the correlation was unlikely." End quote. Likely or not, the Hills believe that this extraterrestrial experience truly did happen to them. By the end of the sessions, the Hills both felt much better. They felt a sense of relief and much less anxiety with this new understanding of events. At Barney's suggestion, the Hills and Dr. Simon agreed that the tapes of their sessions should be preserved so that in the event of their deaths, if the experience was proven true, it would protect them from being considered eccentric. In Dr. Simon's summary of treatment, he indicated, quote, emotional disturbance after an experience with an unidentified flying object, end quote. At first, the medical director had an issue approving the insurance claim based on a diagnosis of a UFO experience. Dr. Simon responded, saying that this was not the diagnosis, but a statement made by Mr. and Mrs. Hill as the reason they had come to seek medical treatment. He provided the medical director with information about the Hills' health, including their persistent anxiety, apprehension, Barney's insomnia, and Betty's repeated nightmares. He also stated that the Hills were suffering amnesia from the night that they claimed to see the UFO, and upon discharge from treatment, both Barney and Betty were considered to be recovered. The claim was settled quickly after receipt of this letter. After the incident, the Hills went back to normal life. Betty continued her job as a social worker, and Barney was able to transfer to the Portsmouth post office, meaning he was no longer required to make the 60-mile commute to work. He now worked the day shift, which was a nice change from his overnights in Boston. They both stayed very active in their communities. They did not attempt to seek publicity, but rather attempted to avoid it. They would only talk to their family and friends about their experience, and when they did, they were able to do so without any disturbance to their emotional well-being. 5 years after the incident, due to extreme public interest, they decided that, quote, a book should be written that would tell the story in complete detail, leaving it up to the reader to decide on its importance based on the facts revealed, end quote. This book is called The Interrupted Journey by John G. Fuller. The Hills arranged for John G. Fuller to write their account of the events for them, and they asked Dr. Simon to release the tape recordings to him. This book contains the report of Betty's dream, transcripts from the tape recordings, and more. The Hills stated that they, quote, hope the publication of this book will enable the reader to judge for himself and decide if this is illusion, hallucination, dream, or reality, end quote. In researching this case, I read the book in full, and I would definitely recommend reading it if you're interested. Barney Hill died of a cerebral hemorrhage on February 25, 1969, at the age of 46. Betty never remarried. She went on to live until the age of 85. She died on October 17, 2004, after a year-long battle with cancer. She cataloged many more UFO sightings in her lifetime and became known as the First Lady of Flying Saucers. In 2008, the University of New Hampshire celebrated the opening of the Betty and Barney Hill Collection. This collection contains thousands of items, including photographs, personal journal entries, letters, newspaper articles, audio tapes, artwork, and more. This September, it will be 60 years since the Hills abduction experience. Illusion? Dream? Hallucination? Or reality? Will we ever find the answer? That's all for today's episode. New episodes of Mystic and Murder will be posted every other Sunday. Tune in and subscribe on Spotify, Anchor, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and more. You can find the podcast on Instagram and Twitter at Mystic and Murder, and you can check out the website at www.mysticandmurder.com. You can send in an email to mysticandmurder@gmail.com with suggestions, requests, and even personal spooky stories. If you like what you hear and you want to support the podcast, you can go to www.patreon.com/mysticandmurder. You can click support at anchor.fm/mysticandmurder. Or you can make a donation at paypal.me/mysticandmurder. Thank you all so much for listening, and I hope you sleep tight. Remember, all things weird lurk at night.